way to address the deficit is to grow the economy. You can grow the economy and you bring in more revenues without having to raise taxes.
Alaska's two senators vote to begin debate on the controversial tax reform bill. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, November 29th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Prudhoe Bay jobs numbers hit their lowest level in a decade.
We're not quite sure whether those numbers are beginning to flatten out or not.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaskans and in the 40 years of Alaska operations.
Now through December 15th is the open enrollment for the health insurance marketplace in Alaska. Plan costs have gone down this year. For free help to enroll, visit getcoveredalaska.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Children's Trust.
Ensure the vitality of public radio by including it in your estate planning. Together, we build a sustainable future for quality media. Thank you.
In the U.S. Senate, every Republican, including both Alaska senators, voted a few hours ago to officially begin debate on a tax cut bill that would also open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling.
On this vote, the yeas are 52, the nays are 48. The motion is agreed to.
The procedural vote allows the Senate to vote on the tax bill itself later this week. Opening the Arctic Refuge to oil development has been the dream of Alaska's congressional delegation since the 1970s. That portion of the bill, though, has hit a technical snag. The Senate parliamentarian has reportedly ruled that part of ANWR language exceeds the limits on what can be included in a budget bill. Senator Lisa Murkowski says the problem is easy to fix.
We are looking forward to the opportunity to wrap things up in a curative amendment. I'm not worried at all.
She issued a statement today saying why she supports the tax bill. Among the features she likes, Murkowski says it will lower taxes for many Alaska families by doubling the child tax credit and the standard deduction. She also likes that the bill would end the mandate that everyone have health insurance. She says people shouldn't have to buy policies they don't want or can't afford. Critics say ending the mandate will drive up premiums because healthy people will leave the market. Senator Dan Sullivan supports the tax bill, too. He says the tax cuts will spur economic growth.
The way to address the deficit is to grow the economy. You can grow the economy and you bring in more revenues without having to raise taxes.
Democrats say the tax cut is a giveaway to corporations and the wealthiest Americans. DNC Chairman Tom Perez told Alaska Public Media, it's just wishful thinking to expect the tax bill won't add enormously to the national debt.
It's fairy dust economics to suggest that all this wonderful growth is going to occur and it will trickle down and help everyone else.
Senator Maria Cantwell of Washington State did not sound optimistic after today's vote that she and fellow Democrats can block drilling in the Arctic Refuge.
Well, it's in this bill. It looks right now that people are continuing to move it forward.
Cantwell says Democrats will try to raise awareness about the refuge and its value as a place for nature, not drilling rigs. This year, job numbers in the Prudhoe Bay region dropped to the lowest levels in a decade, according to the State Labor Department. As of June, just under 9,000 workers were employed in the region, which is dominated by the oil sector and the industries that support it. That's compared to a record high of well over 13,000 jobs in early 2015. Oil prices have gone up a bit recently, but Neil Freed, an economist with the state, says it's hard to predict whether the industry will stop shedding jobs anytime soon.
So we're not quite sure whether those numbers are beginning to flatten out or not. I mean, it's still sort of, we can't answer that question.
Freed estimates that in the first half of this year, more than 2,000 people lost their jobs in Alaska's oil sector. The oil price crash that began in 2014 and the industry layoffs that followed are at the root of Alaska's current recession. But Freed says an economic recovery for Alaska doesn't entirely depend on the oil industry.
It's not going to take a recovery in the oil sector to necessarily cause the recession to come to an end. You know, there could be other industries that even are just growing marginally.
For the first half of 2017, overall job losses in Alaska slowed. Freed says sectors like fisheries, tourism, and the military could help pull the state out of the recession, even if the oil industry doesn't start adding jobs. When a wetland is converted to something other than a wetland, federal law requires the developer make up for the loss in some other way. For big projects, that often means creating or protecting wetlands in other places. But over the last 3 years, this hasn't been happening as often as it used to, and conservation groups are concerned. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports on what these groups are saying and what federal officials say in response.
Brad Micklejohn has been involved in wetland mitigation projects in Alaska for 20 years as state director for the Conservation Fund.
Alaskans have a lot to be proud of. We've done a lot of things right. We haven't screwed up our waterways and our wetlands. That's why we have the quality of life that we are afforded here. Lots of salmon, lots of moose, lots of bird life.
It's the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers' job to decide what wetland development projects require mitigation plans, like the ones Micklejohn has worked on. This can include restoring or preserving wetlands on another part of the same property that's being developed, or it can mean wetlands being preserved or restored on another property. And in the past 3 years, the Corps has required a lot less of this kind of mitigation than it did in the previous several years. Micklejohn believes the Corps has lowered its standards.
We're seeing a pattern where permittees are being encouraged to lowball their mitigation expectations and basically getting away with it.
Steve Brockman in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Juneau office says he's also seen a change.
In recent years, we've been less successful at getting what we consider adequate mitigation for substantial impacts, and we're not quite sure why that is.
Corps officials deny there's been a change. Sheila Newman oversees wetlands regulation for the Corps in Alaska. She says there have just been fewer projects in wetlands in recent years.
I think it would be unfair to look at those numbers and say that there had been a change because those numbers don't reflect the type of projects.
The Southeast Alaska Land Trust helps preserve land to offset wetlands development. For several years, it worked on mitigation estimates for roughly 15 to 20 wetland projects a year. But since May 2015, it's been asked to only look at one. Land Trust Director Allison Gillum says she doesn't know, other than the slump in the economy and state spending, why the drop happened.
To see the decrease that we've seen, I think potentially there's something else kind of also driving the change that we've seen here. And I don't know if we 100% know what that is.
One thing that appears to have changed is the direction the Corps gives the project managers who make decisions about compensatory mitigation. KTOO obtained a document labeled for internal use only that gave examples of cases that would require offsets. These examples were more limited than those in an earlier guide that was publicly available. Micklejohn says appropriate mitigation is crucial for future projects, like the proposed natural gas pipeline.
We're talking about a project that crosses basically the heart of Alaska, countless rivers, you know, wetlands throughout. A lot of those rivers are anadromous fish rivers. They're rivers that Alaskans use, that Alaskans live on and rely on the water quality thereof and the fish and wildlife that those rivers provide.
Corps officials say it's too soon to talk about the potential effect of the pipeline on wetlands. The Corps recently ended the Conservation Fund's participation in the mitigation program, citing the fund's failure to meet federal deadlines. And with the end of the Conservation Fund's mitigation program, there are no active mitigation programs in northern or western Alaska, or in much of the interior. It's not clear who will be responsible for mitigation in those areas now. One more unknown for the future of wetland preservation in Alaska is the Trump administration. Conservation groups don't know what changes might be in store for the state. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the DOC commissioner works to prevent drug trafficking in prison, partly by keeping inmates busy.
All those things are huge preventative pieces. So when you have people occupied, there's less trouble.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
GCI, with complete technology solutions for organizations that keep Alaska's communities and economy thriving. GCI is your partner in possibilities.
From one end of Alaska to the other and everywhere in between, Public Media works to provide quality programming and statewide news you can count on and news you can trust. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in the car, we're grateful to be a part of your day. Thank you for tuning in.
Fairbanks police have identified a man found dead Tuesday morning at a residence on the city's south side. Police say 44-year-old John Thomas Preshaw's death is being investigated as a homicide. Police spokeswoman Yumi McCulloch says officers found Preshaw after responding to a report they received just after 6 a.m. on Tuesday of an unconscious man who was bleeding at a residence on South Cushman Street. She says paramedics pronounced him dead at the scene.
Investigators are still trying to determine the cause of death for Mr. Preshaw.
McCulloch says investigators ask anyone who has information about the homicide to contact the police department. She says investigators are not providing information about suspects at this point.
We don't have any suspect information to release at this time. Investigators have been working this homicide as well as the one from yesterday, so they've been pretty busy.
McCulloch says no additional information about the Monday stabbing death of 57-year-old Jeanette Miller of Fairbanks is being released at this time. Miller was pronounced dead shortly after being transported by paramedics to a hospital early Monday afternoon. Police found her body at the Alaska Motel on the city's south side around noon Monday after receiving a report of a fight between two women and a possible stabbing. The cases are being investigated as the 9th and 10th murders in the city this year, far more than have occurred in Fairbanks in other recent years. The commissioner of the Department of Corrections acknowledges it's easy to access illegal drugs in prison in Alaska. Dean Williams says his department is trying to stop it. In October, five women at Highland Correctional Center in Eagle River overdosed in a 24-hour period, and three men were recently charged with conspiring to smuggle drugs into Goose Creek Correctional Center. Commissioner Dean Williams told Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman the department has a new unit that works with the FBI, the Drug Enforcement Agency, and other partners to stop drug trafficking in prison.
We're making cases and also sharing intelligence in ways that we've never had before. So that, on the enforcement side of things, that's the good news. This doesn't sound all that jazzy on one hand, but the reality is you have to share intelligence. And so we're doing a better job of sharing information and also targeting people that we believe we have better targets now in terms of who we think is trafficking. And that's the reason why we're making some cases now. And so we're not going to be able to prevent drug trafficking by searching people. That's sort of the great misunderstanding, too. Most of these drugs are being packed inside people's bodies, and you cannot search everybody's bodies internally who are coming into prison. You can't. There's civil rights issues, and just operationally, how the heck would you do it? It's impossible. So the one way, and when we find out people who do, by the way, we are going to go after them very thoroughly.
So that's the enforcement side. What's happening in the prevention side? I mean, women have recently overdosed in Highland. What's preventing that from happening?
Well, even with the opioid issue in our state, enforcement is not going to prosecute. We can't prosecute our way out of this. We can't enforce our way out of this. And I can't do that behind the prison walls either. What I can do on the intervention or prevention side, though, is make prisons better places for people to be while we have their freedom. So projects like just happened, like the Lullaby Project and the education things we're doing and treatment behind the walls and really just creating purpose, what I call purpose and jobs, you know, having someone something to do. All those things are huge preventative pieces. So when you have people occupied, there's less trouble. A lot of people know I just came back from Norway, and when I talk about drug trafficking in prison in Norway, they kind of look at me a little sideways, like, well, yeah, that happened like one time a couple years ago or something. And are they different than us? They're not, but they have much less problem than we do. And the reason why is because that everyone behind the walls there has a purpose and a job. They either go to school or they go to work. There's some type of training. The worst thing in terms of running a prison system, whether or not it's drugs or anything else, is idle time on people's hands. And that's That's what I'm out to change.
You seem to be saying that it's, instead of looking at treatment programs and focusing on addiction, you're focusing on keeping people busy and giving them a sense of self-worth.
I'm focusing on both. I believe in treatment programs behind the walls. I think it's very important. But the reality is that even though I think those activities are important, our recidivism rate hasn't changed in 20 years.
Even though the programs
have been going on. And just say, well, just why not eliminate the programs? I tell you exactly why, because you still need, there's some that still are saved by that activity. So I don't want to make anything worse by removing them entirely. But having very productive time, lots of activities, many paths forward, both treatment, jobs, vocational training, I want it all.
That was Commissioner Dean Williams with the Department of Corrections speaking with Ann Hillman, Alaska Public Media's Solutions Desk reporter. In an effort to pay for growing costs from substance abuse, Anchorage could weigh a potential new tax on alcohol. The measure is an ambition of the long-serving head of the Anchorage Assembly. But as Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, it faces an uphill battle with critics from multiple sides.
For most of the last 26 years, Dick Traney has been on the Assembly. In between election defeats and stints away, Traney has chaired the 11-member body five separate times. And one of the most frequent targets of his criticism is all the ways the city ends up paying for extra expenses associated with alcohol.
It does not even begin to cover its cost on society.
In meetings on homelessness, public safety, downtown renewal, budgets, parks, and trails, Traney and the Assembly hear a consistent chorus of complaints and consternation about all the ways residents pay for services directly related to problems that arise from drinking.
My tax dollars still go to support the police department that deals with the problem of alcoholism. My tax dollars still go to support Health and Human Services to clean up the problem that alcohol creates.
In a town and a state where alcohol plays a big role, Traney himself doesn't drink.
You know, but I grew up with a family that drank constantly. Every Saturday and Sunday night, the family would get together at my grandparents' place, where I would watch my aunts and uncles, my grandparents, play poker and drink all weekend.
Traney grew up in Washington and came to Anchorage with the Air Force in 1971. He spent a career in the military and civil service, and along with his wife, raised eight kids. Traney concedes that his abstinence does guide some of his policies aimed at prohibitions on drugs and alcohol, but he also insists that the city's relationship with booze has led to an irresponsible financial burden on public resources. And he wants to add a new wholesale tax on alcohol to raise extra revenues.
We could use it for the police department. It could be treatment beds. It could be anything we can do to stem the tide of alcoholism or its effect on society.
Alcohol sales are already taxed by the state, but it's a perennial source of frustration for Traney and many other officials in Anchorage that those tens of millions of dollars collected can't be specifically dedicated to pay for treatment options. And they say that of the money spent by the state, Anchorage isn't getting its fair share of what it chips in. Traney wants a local tax so officials can designate the money. His proposal would introduce a 2% tax that could go as high as 6% in the future, but the politics are not on Traney's side. It takes a supermajority of eight assembly votes to put the measure on the April ballot, then it needs to get a majority from voters. Traney's similar efforts in the past have failed, but he insists the municipality can't adequately address a worsening problem at current funding levels.
Our population has grown dramatically over the years, and there's just not the money out there to take care of this problem.
If approved, Traney says the tax would raise about $1.4 million in its first year. But industry groups don't plan on letting things get that far. Darwin Buer, owner of the downtown bar Darwin's Theory, says the Alaska Cabaret, Hotel, Restaurant, and Retailers Association, along with other groups, have a war chest ready to fight the tax proposal if it advances.
We have $100,000 coming from Alaska Char, then we have the manufacturers, we have the distributors, we have the whole alcohol industry against this sort of thing.
Buer says the tax places an unfair burden on businesses and employees in a broad swath of the Anchorage economy. He says it would penalize bars and restaurants for behavior that's happening mostly on the streets by a small subset of drinkers dealing with dysfunction and mental health issues. Buer thinks taxing alcohol to curb social problems is misguided.
Alcohol is not the cause. Alcohol is an effect.
That's not a view shared by public health advocates, many of whom say the industry has too much influence in developing alcohol-related policy in Anchorage. Some advocates point toward the upcoming rewrite of the state legal code on alcohol during the next legislative session as their primary focus for reforms. Jeff Jesse is the former CEO of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and has spent years working on alcohol policy in Alaska. He says the pending revisions in state alcohol laws represent years of work getting regulators, public health advocates, and the industry all in the same boat.
This is as close to a consensus bill as you're going to get in an issue in where there are a variety of strongly held opinions.
The worry in some corners is the trainees' tax proposal could court a fight with the industry that might damage a fragile relationship between stakeholders typically at odds with one another just before a big legislative lift in the coming session. The measure goes up for public testimony before the Assembly on December 19th. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com. Do you need health insurance for next year? Did you know Alaska's individual market health insurance rates have dropped by more than 20% for 2018? More than 90% of Alaskans who sign up at healthcare.gov are eligible for tax credits to help pay the costs. Open enrollment is November 1st through December 15th of this year. Check out healthcare.gov to find out what your insurance options are for 2018. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Insurance.
The Chukchi Sea should be almost fully covered in sea ice by now. Instead, it's mostly open water. Brian Bretschneider with our Ask a Climatologist segment says the ice coverage right now in the Chukchi is typical for mid-October, not late November.
Normally by this date, it's 88% covered in ice. This year, it's only 46% covered in ice. And that is dramatically lower than even the second lowest year, which would be 2014. So very, very low ice coverage for this region. Unprecedented.
And a record low by a wide margin.
By a very wide margin. Now, I should say that we're talking the satellite era, which would be 1979 through present. But it's fair to assume we have historical data that goes out even to the late 1800s. It's not as complete, obviously, as the satellite era, but there's really nothing even in that data set that comes close to where the sea ice is for 2017 through the end of November.
What does that mean for weather in Alaska?
Well, this area is really important all the Arctic is very important, but because it's adjacent to Alaska and because it's the direction of the prevailing flow through much of the winter, it's really important because that area, when it's open water, it's about 30 degrees and it's providing a lot of warmth to the atmosphere. When it's covered in ice, that warmth is locked in underneath it. And so if you have a flow of air that's moving from, say, the northwest, as it's crossing over that water, it's going to become a lot warmer. If it's locked in ice, it's going to be a lot colder. It's also going to be picking up more moisture as it's moving over the open water. So there's a lot of kind of local near-term weather impacts from having that open water.
Is there any ice near Uktiagvik?
Looking at the Geophysical Institute Sea Ice webcam, at least this morning, there was no ice. There's been a little bit of ice here and there at the very, very near shore. But basically, there's no ice there up at Uktiagvik. And talking with Rick Toman from the Fairbanks National Weather Service office, he's indicated that in the last number of decades, the latest that it's taken for the ice to fill in there is mid-November. So at least, you know, for the last 30, 40, and probably more years than that, this is the latest it's ever taken to fill in the ice there in the nearshore areas.
Brian Bretschneider is a climatologist in Anchorage. If you have a climate-related question, send an email to akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. There's a new light display in Sitka, and no, we're not talking about the kind that twinkle. The city recently installed overhead lights at the Turnaround Skate Park, a popular hangout spot for skaters and scooter riders looking to catch some air. KCAW's Emily Kwong reports.
So full disclosure, I missed the exact moment the city turned the lights on for the first time. But a pack of elementary school boys was all too happy to recreate their reaction. Heck yeah! 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 That's Chris Cropley, Joshua McGraw, Tyson Bartolaba, Dylan Solser, and Leon Barclay joyfully tossing their scooters into the air.
Wait, that was your reaction to them turning the lights on?
Yeah.
Why did you react so strongly?
Because like we thought it was gonna like be darker and stuff, but it's actually really lighter, and now we can see better.
So we always had to leave at like 5 o'clock.
Oh, yeah. Not even. Yeah, I get two. At, like,
the four LED lights are bright enough to light the bowl, a concrete oasis for those on wheels. And with the sun setting earlier these winter months, the addition of lights buys the skaters hours of time and parents some peace of mind. This is Jane Bradley.
The kids hate the winter because it gets dark, and I'm like, well, it's dark out, we can't go certain places, but this I am comfortable with. It's well lit, and we can see it even from the road side, so...
The lights were installed by the city's public works and electric departments, with multiple permits from the State Department of Conservation. That's because the park was built near an old turnaround for planes. The lights have been a dream of the Sitka Police Department since they began receiving complaints of drunk and disorderly conduct by non-skating adults. The lack of lighting provided a cover, and the skate park got a bit of a bad rap. Lieutenant Lance Ewers helped push for the installation of video cameras, but is even more confident that finally installing lights will prevent future crime.
So by putting the lights in combination with the cameras, we could give that skate park back to what it was originally designed to be, a safe place for children to hang out and have a good time and in a nice, safe environment.
Right now, the lights are illuminated 24 hours a day, though Ewers says they may run on a timer in the future. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Elizabeth Harbaugh, Annie Fight, Ann Hillman, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Emily Kwong in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Alaska Humanities Forum grants support creative projects that share the stories of Alaska and explore what it means to be Alaskan. Get details and apply at akhf.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Humanities Forum.
4 out of 5 Alaskans addicted to heroin started by using prescription opioids. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medications prevents anyone from taking them without permission, which could endanger them and lead to consequences with law enforcement. Find out more at opioids.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Support for public radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play in your public radio station. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.